I call this meeting of the Conference Committee on House File 2432, the Judiciary and Public Safety Budget Bill, to order. We do have a quorum. Before we get to our agenda, just like to go through a few items. Everyone here today must be seated in the hearing room. There's no standing or sitting in the walkways or aisles. If you need any accommodation, please be sure to check in with our sergeant staff. Signs aren't permitted in the hearing room or at the testifiers table, and clapping other disruptions are not allowed. Thank you to our sergeant's office staff who are present for helping maintain decorum in the committee hearing room. Today's agenda includes adopting additional policy that's been agreed to by the House and Senate and to hear testimony on several provisions that are still being considered. We're going to first start with the testimony, and if we do not finish by 1:30, which I am guessing we probably won't, we will need to recess to the call of the chair. Just so members know, we did drop Senate File 281 from today's agenda as the testifier was unable to join us today. And so as we move through this testimony, the idea is, because we have to recess at 1:30, to try to get through as much of the testimony on the bills as possible so that our testifiers aren't having to sit around and wait for us to come back. So we will call on the testifiers for the bills. We'll have member questions for the testifiers, but we'll come back and revisit any discussion on those bills later on. All right, so the first provision we will take testimony on is from Senate File 1665 and House File 1396. These provisions expand the use of drones by law enforcement. A side-by-side of the two proposals has been posted online and printed for the members. There's also an amendment that's been offered by the Senate that's been shared online and printed. And members, you should have the documents in your committee packets. And then before we start with the testimony, I would like House Counsel Jeff Diebel to walk through the differences in the various proposals. Mr. Diebel.
Madam Chair and members, I'll be working off the document. It's entitled H1396-2 on the left side, which is the House language, and it compares it to the Senate position on UAVs. The bill amends four different clauses in the UAV statute. It begins with on line 1.10 of the House side. There's a difference there where it provides for preserving evidence, to using drones to preserve evidence. And on the House side, it refers to documenting evidence that would be subject to risk, imminent risk, if the use of a drone was not involved. And on the Senate side, it refers to preserve and protect evidence from imminent risk of destruction. Moving to the next change item, you have 1.13 of the House side. The standard for using drones for fleeing suspects. On the House side, it's a probable cause standard, and that is related to probable cause that the person committed a crime against a person or a felony and is fleeing law enforcement. And on the Senate side, as brought into conference committee, it was a reasonable suspicion standard that the person might or is fleeing. The amendment that's been offered for consideration by the Senate would maintain the reasonable belief standard for the use of the drone, but it would be a reasonable belief that a crime was committed and that the person is fleeing or might flee police officers. Moving to the next change in both sides is identical, and it relates to the using a drone in a private area with the written consent of the occupant, and that's tied to the public area or current provision, which allows for the use in public area for officer training or public relations purposes. And on the second page of the side-by-side is another new provision on both sides. The House has added a few additional requirements related to the use of drones for missing persons. On the House side, the drone can be used for an active search when the missing person involves a risk of death or bodily harm to the person. And on the Senate side, it simply is states that to facilitate the search for a missing person. And Madam Chair, that concludes the overview.
Thank you, Mr. Diebel. Next, we'll move on to testimony. If we can have Chief Potts, Sheriff Habel, and Superintendent Evans. We have three chairs, so if you all want to come on up to the table. And we'll begin with Executive Director Potts. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony. Welcome back.
Thanks, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jeff Potts, Executive Director for the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, representing the roughly 300 police chiefs across the state, as well as a couple of hundred command staff officers. I'll be brief, Madam Chair. Our association supports, with regard to the three provisions in front of you, I'm referring to the R1. This is a side-by-side that was on the stack outside. The first item that we support is the House version on line .10 to document evidence that is an imminent risk of destruction. We prefer that over the language that says to preserve and protect evidence. Basically, our position is that the drone can't really preserve and protect. However, it can document. Moving on to the second area that we will weigh in on, and that is in regard to the fleeing, language regarding fleeing. We support the A32 amendment. Mr. Diebel just read through that. That is to assist in the lawful pursuit of a suspect who law enforcement reasonably believes has committed a crime and who is fleeing law enforcement or law enforcement reasonably believes might flee. The third provision that the Chiefs Association supports is on the backside of the R2, and that is the Senate language that simply states to facilitate the search for a missing person. Madam Chair, that is the three areas and the positions of the Chiefs Association. Thank you for allowing me to testify here today.
Thank you for your testimony. And Sheriff Hable, if you want to introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. My name is Scott Hable. I'm the sheriff in Renville County, Minnesota, and I also represent the Minnesota Sheriff's Association today. Regarding these bills, we largely echo what Executive Director Potts just told you. I'll give you some insight as to why on a couple of these. The first one, the Senate side, again, documenting evidence as opposed to preserving and protecting evidence. While they both, I think, accomplish the same thing, if we're talking about the literal task that a drone can do, a drone can document. A drone doesn't necessarily preserve or protect. If it does, it's done so by documenting. So we think that the House side is the preferred language. Moving on to the use of drones for fleeing suspects, similar to the Chiefs, we would support the newly filed A32 amendment on the Senate side. And then, of course, there, I believe, is consensus over using drones over private areas. And so the last piece then would be using drones in the search for missing people. Our preference is the Senate language in that as well, to facilitate the search for a missing person. And there's a couple of caveats to this. The House side requires that it be an active search for a person that involves risk of death or great bodily harm. There might be some confusion as to when that happens. Many of you have heard my testimony in previous committee meetings. In rural Minnesota, a large part of our geography is covered in agricultural land. And so just as an example, from time to time we get calls about missing children that are in fields. On a bluebird sky day at 70 degrees, if a two-year-old child goes into a cornfield, are they at risk of death or bodily harm? The answer is no, but at some point they might be. And so our question is, at what point is it that we can launch a drone? If you are the parent of that two-year-old child who's missing, I can assure you, you're going to want and you deserve every piece of equipment available to be used to search for your small child, whether or not there's risk of bodily harm or death. So we think the Senate version, simply to facilitate the search for a missing person, is the better of the two options.
All right, thank you. And next up we have Superintendent Evans. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Drew Evans. I'm Superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I would just like to highlight as well that the additions of the Chiefs Association, the Sheriff's Association have both highlighted that we would be in agreement with. I will note that the specific provision the BCA originally brought forward is in lines 100.17 and 100.18, and these have been combined as it's worked its way through the process. However, the addition is that they have noted I would be in agreement with exactly what they've testified testified here today. You'll note that the A32 amendment would certainly be a reasonable perspective as well, but that the Senate version or the A32 amendment would be the preference of the BCA. The reason being is that this was brought forward as it relates to our work in violent crime, a reduction in our teams, and what we often find is we have individuals that flee for us where we'd be able to utilize a UAV so that we can launch that. If the person flees, and a lot of times we anticipate they may flee based on previous conduct, a number of different factors that we'd be looking at, by utilizing the UAV, we'd be able to set a perimeter and slow down so that our law enforcement officers, as we're working with our partners every day, are not having to chase them, often with guns drawn through backyards. We can set that perimeter, locate them with the UAV, and then call them out in a much more orderly fashion, which keeps the individual that's fleeing safer, and it keeps our law enforcement safer. So either the Senate position or A32 would be the preference of the BCA as this moves forward.
Okay, thanks for your testimony. And then we have Alicia Granz from the ACLU. And if the other testifiers could just hang by close so that we can have the opportunity for questions. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mohler. My name is Alicia Granzi, and I'm a staff attorney at the Minnesota ACLU. I'm here today to testify on behalf of the Constitution, which has a warrant requirement that is vital to protecting our rights against unreasonable searches and seizures. When looking at the two proposals before us, the ACLU of Minnesota supports the House side, which requires that someone actually be fleeing from law enforcement rather than a reasonable belief that someone may flee. I appreciate the concerns of the law enforcement that testified here today, but I want to make sure that the people of Minnesota also have an opportunity to have their voices heard. And particularly in light of the fact that in several weeks, it will be the fifth anniversary of the murder of George Floyd, I want to make sure that we are taking into account law enforcement practices that are unreasonable. Two reports on the Minneapolis Police Department documented the unreasonable conduct of law enforcement across our state, well, in particular in Minneapolis. And I want to make sure that though we say something might be reasonable in this statute, law enforcement don't always act reasonably. The reason the House side mentions probable cause and the warrant requirement, this warrant requirement is very important. This comes from our Constitution. These are the ways that we protect Minnesotans from unreasonable law enforcement search and seizure. We've worked with members of the House to craft this language so that it does really conform to the protections that all Minnesotans have under the Constitution. And I would open up for any questions at this point.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. We will open it up for member questions, I guess, and then we'll have member comments. Again, we'll save. We'll bring this back up later to discuss. So let's try to keep it to questions now. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your comments. You didn't say anything about this last provision, and I also actually wanted to ask the law folks about their view of this, too, but on the back side of the page here where we have, they discussed, this is the missing person section, and a difference between the two sides is that the House side says to facilitate the active search for a missing person, in addition to the piece that says that limits it by, that involves risk of death or bodily harm. And then the Senate side is just to facilitate the search for a missing person, much broader. So I wonder if you had a comment on that piece, on the differences there and whether active is important.
Ms. Granzi.
Thank you, member. Yes, I do have a comment. The reason that the active word is included there is to separate searches for missing persons that may have originated far in the past, 10, 15 years, even a year ago. The reason active is important is that this is something that is potentially an emergency. And again, the warrant requirement is something that we have to as a backstop. So law enforcement goes to a judicial officer and the judicial officer says, yes, it is reasonable for you to use this technology in this way. When there is an emergency, an emergent situation, potentially they don't have time to get a warrant, but that's not the case in investigations that are from far in the past. So it's much easier for a law enforcement agency to get a warrant in order to do that.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And then did you also have a comment on having the inclusion of that phrase that involves the risk of death or bodily harm versus not including it? Say we were just to include the term active.
Ms. Granzi.
Is that enough?
Thank you, Chair and Chair Liebling. Yes, I do have a comment. The reason that we have those phrases in there, and I would mention that it is bodily harm, which is not a very high standard, it is not great bodily harm, is, again, to ensure that what law enforcement is doing is actually exigent. It's actually a situation where, you know, we are concerned about the health of citizens. The sheriff mentioned children, and I would argue that if a child is lost in a cornfield, there could be bodily harm happening to that child, even on a beautiful day. Again, bodily harm is not a high, high bar. It is not that the child will be, you know, will die. It is any harm to the body. So that would be our comment on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I know I said to save comments, but I had pulled up the definition of bodily harm just so people know it is defined in statute as physical pain or injury, illness, or any impairment of a physical condition. So it is a very low standard to reach. Okay, other questions for, yeah, go ahead, Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm looking at the difference between item number one on the side-by-side on lines 1.8 and 1.9 and trying to compare that to the missing person piece on the back side. And for the record, item one says during or in the aftermath of an emergency situation that involves the risk of death or bodily harm to a person. And maybe law enforcement can help me out here, but wouldn't that include a missing person?
So we want to, I don't know who wants to answer this. Do we want maybe the chiefs or sheriffs to come back up to the testifier table? If there's a gap in the current law that doesn't cover missing persons. And the superintendent, they're all coming. But Ms. Granzi, stay close by too as well.
Okay, would you Thank like you. Me to?
Just, you're fine. All right, go ahead, Sheriff.
If I understand the question correctly, Madam Chair, the question is, does lines 1.8 and 1.9, yeah, is that sufficient to cover the new language? Is that correct?
Chair Scott.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, it seems like the language that says during or in the aftermath of an emergency situation. So if someone is missing, in my mind, that's an emergency situation. So why would we need the language on the backside if we have kind of this sort of exigent circumstance, broader language in 1.8 and 1.9?
Sheriff.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this, again, goes to just interpretation of the literal meanings of these terms. An emergency to one person is much different than an emergency to another person. I think the idea is just to clarify exactly when we can and cannot use UAVs. And again, these are exceptions to a search warrant requirement. And in some of these cases, I'm not sure that a search warrant is even appropriate. Perhaps a court order, but a search warrant would be difficult in these situations because there is no crime that's committed. It's not evidence of a crime. I'm not sure what the mechanics of that might look like.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I happen to see that, and I'm thinking, but I think what we passed into law several years ago already kind of allowed for this sort of thing, but I understand the belt and suspenders approach, I guess. So.
You know, Chief Potts, did you have more to add for that question?
You know, I think that, Madam Chair and members, thanks. I think the sheriff did a fine job. I would just add to get to this point about it's sometimes a question as to whether or not it's an emergency, and adding a clause in missing persons, I think is appropriate. We think about a small child in a farm field, or as was talked about, but this happens almost a daily basis where some elderly person with dementia has gone out for a walk and simply hasn't returned. And that's also a missing person case, may not be considered an emergency situation to some, but to that person's family member, I would argue that it is. I think this just clarifies when you're searching for a missing person. And drones can be extremely valuable in those situations in terms of quickly, especially if the weather is obviously a factor. So I think it's just for clarity.
Thank you. Chair Letts.
Thank you. On this missing person thing, I'm just trying to figure out why you wouldn't use a drone in any situation. I mean, if the standard is a little bit of pain, is bodily harm, which is the standard definition, then that's basically no standard at all, because anyone who trips while they're out missing, where they wouldn't trip if they were back home, might be exposed to a risk of bodily harm, number one. Number two, someone is missing, especially if they're a young child or if they're vulnerable in some way. Even if they aren't exposed to bodily harm risk, the mental anguish that they might be experiencing in relating to not being where they're supposed to be, being lost or whatever, seems to me is worth it. And third, if you've got people to be out looking, spending resources, collecting friends, family, relatives, law enforcement, anyone else, go out and try to find this person who's missing. Why wouldn't we just use a drone to find them? I don't see what the harm is on that, if it would expedite the discovery and recovery of a person that's out there. And the final thing is, how the heck do you prove that you're in compliance with this statute? Right. If someone asks a question later on, says, well, were they at risk? Well, we don't know if they were at risk. We're not wherever they are. I mean, they might be standing under a tree during a sunny day, and they're fine, but they're still lost, and their family is still worried to death about them. They don't know where they are. As far as the family might think they're standing next to a pond about to fall in, and they don't know how to swim, no matter what age they are. I mean, there'd be no way to prove that you've complied or not complied. It'd be a complete fabrication of ideas to try to comply with this. So I think we're better off just saying, use whatever tools, human or technological, to find someone who's missing. So for me, that, I guess I don't have a question. I'm just trying to figure this out. And I did have a question, maybe it's a comment, I'm not even sure, on the middle portion also, fleeing or think they're going to flee. And maybe this is a question for Ms. Gramsci from the ACLU. How do you distinguish between using physical human resources in a squad car or officers in uniform surrounding a person they think they might flee, from having a hovering camera also surrounding a person who might flee to prevent that flight? I guess I don't understand the ACLU's distinction there, so maybe you can help me understand that.
Ms. Gransey.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Senator Letts. presumably, even with the drone being in the air, the law enforcement agency is still going to have boots on the ground. What we're worried about is at a traffic stop, for example, someone is stopped at a traffic stop and the law enforcement agent potentially thinks, you know, I've pulled this person over before, they may have fled, but I've also pulled them over and they haven't fled. But it's potentially reasonable for me to believe that they're going to flee, so I'm going to put a drone up and I'm going to just intimidate them with that drone, which again, they are being pulled over, but it's another question of, you know, we have these resources, but do we need to use them all the time? Having a more tailored and narrow exception to this is very important because again, while it is important to, you know, as law enforcement talk about, to fight crime, the Supreme Court has talked about how in our zeal to address the problems, we can't give police unsupervised powers to invade our privacy. And again, I appreciate the idea of curbing the use of police resources and being smart about it. I think without these cabins, without these guardrails, we're at risk of essentially eating the warrant requirement. So the exceptions are so broad that we don't have a warrant requirement at all. And again, if a if a police officer, and potentially I'm thinking about officers who are executing what they are saying are high-risk warrants, there's already a warrant in place, they can simply ask for additional resources from the government or from the judicial system for permission to use a drone. It is not that difficult to get a search warrant. I wish it were more difficult, but at the end of the day, it is a relatively quick process from what I have gathered in my experience as a criminal defense attorney. And it is possible to get a warrant in a relatively quick enough time frame that you would want to go and to execute these high-risk search warrants or these high-risk arrests.
Chair Letts.
Yeah, thank you. Just a follow-up. If you're talking about you've done an investigation, you think someone's got drugs in their apartment, you're going to do a search warrant, you think they might flee, yeah, you got plenty of time to get a warrant. If you're at a traffic stop and it's a lawful stop, you've already got articulable suspicion under the Constitution to stop them. Assumption, but that's the constitutional threshold. In the time it takes to get a warrant to put up a drone, they're long gone. You can't do that. I mean, it takes a second for someone to step on the gas. It takes at least 15 minutes to half an hour to get a warrant, especially if you're sitting in a squad car, submitting it on your mobile data terminal, and gets sent off to wherever a judge is who steps out of a hearing to look at the warrant and review it. I mean, it just doesn't happen that quickly. You see it all the time when there are warrants for blood or urine tests on DWI arrests. I mean, it takes a little bit of time. So it seems to me if you've already met the constitutional threshold for a stop, which is where you are at in this stuff here, you've already got a lawful pursuit of a suspect, then whether you use a human body or technology, if you got one officer and you can't rally 10 other squad cars to that location quickly enough, but you've got a drone you can put up and maybe save a few lives in the process so you don't have someone makes a stupid decision to flee when they know there's a drone's going to follow them. Maybe you save some family from being hit T-boned in an intersection. Or you save the life of a passenger in that vehicle when they hit a tree. I make a living holding government accountable as well for stepping across constitutional boundaries, but I just don't see how this would intrude on the constitutional boundaries. I don't see warrant as an alternative for these situations. So, thank you.
All right, we have two members that have raised their hands, and then we have to, I'm sorry, we're going to have to recess. Chair Novotny.
Quickly, Chair Mueller, to answer Senator Latz's question, is probably the only person at the table that I can tell has ever detasseled corn. If you're out in any cornfield in July, you're at risk of bodily harm. I have two questions.
The bugs are really big.
Well, death by a thousand cuts. My question would be, but first for the sheriff, we have under the House provision line 1.8, during or the aftermath of emergency situation involves risk of death, bodily harm. And that'll tie to my next question, but would you consider a person that's suicidal and has wandered off into a field or a wooded area to be that emergency situation that would be covered under risk of bodily harm?
Sheriff Hable.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, the answer is it depends. For me personally, absolutely. But again, that the definition of emergency would certainly change from person to person. This clarification in this change in statute would make it clear for anyone. If that is an emergency, it is what it is. You don't have to define it as an emergency. Nobody would be able to come back later and say, that was not an emergency. You shouldn't have done that. You stepped over the constitutional line. Instead, we fall into parent 12 on the Senate side, facilitate the search for a missing person.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And the next question will be for Superintendent Evans. Superintendent Evans, just for clarification and to get it on the record, missing person, would a person, going back to the question I had before about someone that's suicidal, someone's suicidal and believed to be armed, for example, would they meet the definition from what you're reading as missing person? Would they have to be actively involved or entered into the state computers as missing, or an attempt to locate for suicidal or a COPS grant? Would they count as being missing under these statutes?
Superintendent.
Madam Chair and Chair Novotny, yes, I don't think they'd have to be necessarily entered as, you know, missing, but it'd be reported in some way if we didn't know their location. You know, one thing that I would, as I answer the question, that I do think is important, because I think it's come up in some of the questions along the way, many of these uses we're debating are constitutional. The challenge is we have a statute that's narrower than the Constitution, and so that's why we're working through some of these. If this statute didn't exist, many of what we're asking for here today to be added back into this are constitutionally permissible under our statutes right now. With a traditional aircraft, for example, all of these have been done for many, many years under the Constitution, and we'd have to justify that in the process. But that's where I think some of this nuance that we lose of the process is we're trying to add back in what would traditionally be exceptions to the warrant requirement already. And so that's what we're trying to narrowly tailor them with these exceptions we're asking for.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mulley.
All right, Senator Umover-Bayton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question for Ms. Grancy. I know that you talked about concerns with using reasonably believes in the amendment and law enforcement reasonably believes might flee. Can you talk about the House language asks for probable cause to believe has committed either a crime against persons or a felony, whereas this amendment just says committed a crime, and your take on that?
Ms. Grancy.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Senator Umover-Bayton. If I understand your question, it's to compare the amendment. Let me just pull it up here. The House language with to assist in the lawful pursuit of a suspect who law enforcement reasonably believes has committed a crime. Mm-hmm. Again, the reason we are tying this to probable cause to believe that someone has committed a crime is, again, that is language in the Constitution. And we don't want people, law enforcement, chasing people who are moving away from them simply because an officer and generally the standard is reasonable articulable suspicion of committing a crime. Officers have talked about how someone walking away from them is potentially going to give them reasonable suspicion that the person has committed a crime, and the Constitution does not allow that. So what we're doing is trying to tie the language closely to the constitutional requirements to when law enforcement can be acting to enforce a criminal law. So probable cause to believe that someone has committed a crime against a person or a felony. Again, spending law enforcement resources to pursue someone who has reasonable suspicion to has committed a misdemeanor, generally, we want to think about, is that something that a law enforcement officer really needs to be doing? When we're chasing people, like, because that is what this is, it's a pursuit, it's a chase, which intimidates people. We want to make sure that we're doing it for the right reasons. And again, if I may, I want to clarify this, the House section allows for when someone is fleeing. So if someone is fleeing, the drone could be used without a warrant. If law enforcement simply reasonably believe that someone will flee, that's essentially removing a lot of the constitutional protections that we do have. We want to have higher standards for when police are engaging in, again, chasing and pursuing people.
Senator,
I hope that answers your question.
Senator Umover-Bayton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that was helpful. And you talked about misdemeanors, but I'm just curious if you have any specific situations that you're concerned about if there wasn't a probable cause standard that's also tied to crimes against persons or a felony.
Ms. Grantee.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Senator Umover-Bayton. You know, what we're worried about is over-enforcement of what we call livability crimes. frequently something like trespass or public urination or minor theft. You know, those are misdemeanors. And under the Senate side language and the amendment proposed, those would be things that we would use a drone for or to chase and pursue someone. And so we're concerned that law enforcement are going to be using these tools in ways that are not cabined and in ways that aren't really appropriate. We don't want to use all of the tools we have for everything. We want to make sure that we're doing smart policing and constitutional policing.
Any follow-up, Senator?
Okay.
All right. I don't see any other questions from... Oh, go ahead, Chair Scott.
Well, Madam Chair, I can hold that if we're going to resume this topic when we come back, or if we're not, I just had one last question.
Go, please ask your, because we will release the testifier, so if you have questions okay. for the testifiers, please
okay,
go ahead.
Very fine. I do think on the last page there at the top, to facilitate the search for a missing person, I do think there has to be some narrowness to that. It can't be that broad because you may have an open case for a missing person that's a year old. And after so many months or so much time has passed, in my mind, law enforcement would need to go, you know, get a warrant if they, for some reason, wanted to start searching again. You can't leave that case open forever because it's no longer exigent circumstances. It's no longer emergency. That was my only point. No question, I guess,
okay.
Reed, but just that point.
All right. So not seeing any other questions from our members. So thank you to our testifiers. We will release you. Sorry to the other testifiers that we did not get to your testimony. And I will move a recess to the call of the chair. Staff will send out an email to members and the listserv when we plan to reconvene today. And with that, we are in recess. I call the Conference Committee on House File 2432 back to order. The next provision we'll take testimony on is from Senate File 3051. This is related to the release of certain data related to collision crash investigations. The language can be found in the side-by-side in Article 11, Section 8, lines 169.27 to 170.22. I don't have the R3.
What R is it? Oh, the page?
Yeah. Okay, it's R12. So Article 11, R12, lines 169.27 is where that begins. And we will move to our first testifier, Joel Carlson. If you can introduce yourself and begin your testimony, please. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. And our association brought this issue forward. I want to just briefly give the House side for sure a refresher on what this issue was all about. We've noticed a kind of wasteful process that has developed when accident victims seek body cam or dash cam footage. And what happens currently is that the local unit of government or other unit of government, state government, when they get the request for the dash cam video or body cam video, they redact out anyone except the subject that made the request for the data. The parties, whether it's the insurance company or the plaintiff's lawyer, then has to make a request to the court to get the unredacted video of which they are entitled to. The court, in all of the instances that we're aware of, grants the motion to release the unredacted video to the parties for the purpose of the case. We brought this bill forward, quite frankly, as a cost savings to local government. Redacting the video is expensive, and it is needless in this instance because at the end of the day, after a court motion and court time, the unredacted video is always released. The bill was heard in Senate Judiciary on three different occasions, and we've tried to share the language and have shared the language with everyone that we think has an interest, and we made some modifications to the bill based on feedback. Those include making sure that there is a written request for the information. There's no affirmative duty to release it. You have to get a written request, and that request has to be accompanied by the accident report for the case that you're talking about. And there are only very limited people under Chapter 169 who are entitled to an accident report. The people involved in the accident, their insurance companies, their lawyers, or potentially the lawyer for the next of kin. That's all this bill does, or this language does. It allows the law enforcement the ability to release unredacted accident video unless, and I think that's important that we remember this, they retain all of their rights to not release the data. If there is an active investigation, if it shocks the sensibilities, if it is data that is somehow classified as private under some other section of the law. And so we have tried to address concerns. We've even put in a provision on line 17.11 and 12 that once the requester gets the information, they can only use it for the purposes of that claim or as court evidence. They can't redistribute it. And we don't have that obligation now. This is a more protective use of the data and more restrictive use of the data than what the current law is. And the reason I say, Madam Chair and members, that we're entitled to the data is in 2015, there was a case called Burks versus Metropolitan Council. And the Supreme Court held in that case that a subject of the data is entitled to all of the data, even if it contains other subjects who have not consented to the release. And so that's been the law in the state of Minnesota since 2015. And we're not trying to do anything that law enforcement doesn't want to do. And if they don't want to give this data up, I think this provision gives them ample opportunity to do so. It is not an affirmative duty to produce video in every single case. And we'd appreciate your consideration for this, which we think is a cost savings to local municipalities and others that are having to redact video for no good purpose. And we're happy to answer questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. If you can stick around, too, we'll get through the other testifiers, and then we'll open it up for questions. I think next up we have Colonel Bogoyevich here from the State Patrol.
It's State Trooper Day at the Capitol. I'd rather not have a fight with them today.
You are outnumbered here today with them here. Yes. Hi, welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Christina Bogoyevich, and I have the honor of serving as the Colonel of the Minnesota State Patrol. We do just want to bring forward some concerns of the impact to our agency. The original discussions on body-worn camera language, many times those videos show people at their worst times, the worst time in their life, and so protecting that data is important. In the current language, under data classification, it says it must be redacted if the subject doesn't consent. And so it's not the subject of the event, but any subject of that data is personal data. And so they have to give consent. If they do not, then it needs to be redacted. And so I understand the testimony that was given prior, but it's no cost savings or time saving for us because we would still have to go through that to see if any of these exceptions apply. The current law says the subject of the request, and the new language expands that to all those who would get a crash report. And so that does expand the number of people who will be requesting these videos or the body-worn camera video. Also, it says something about the requester must not disseminate the information, but there's no liability clause with that. So what happens if it does go out? For us, that liability includes a lawsuit of releasing private data or something that isn't considered public data. And so in the new language, there is no liability clause there. We're more than willing to continue to talk about this as we did prior to, but we do believe there is some conflicting information in the current data practices laws, along with what's being requested for the collision piece of it.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And do we have a fiscal note yet on this? Has it been complete? I'll turn over to nonpartisan staff. I don't know. Mr. Turner, do you know if a note's been provided?
Yeah, we have a preliminary fiscal note where the Department of Public Safety has estimated a cost of $4 million in 26 and $3,304,000 each year thereafter.
Okay, thank you. We had just, when we discussed this, we talked about the fact that there was not a note requested or at least available prior to this, before we started discussing this bill. So, okay, member questions. Senator Letts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess to Mr. Turner first, could we have a copy of that fiscal note distributed? Please, I'd like to take a look at the assumptions that were made in it. Appreciate it. And then for the Colonel, how is it handled now when there is active litigation and the information that would be the subject of this data request is ordered to be released as part of litigation? What process do you go through? Do you redact at that point? Do you get subject permissions at that point?
Colonel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair, we do require consent. However, we have never had a court order for this. I know there was testimony that some of the local agencies have, but we have never had a court order to release this unredacted. And so all of the information that we release is by consent, redacted.
Chair Letts.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Colonel, maybe I should ask Mr. Carlson as well. My understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't do much in the way of civil litigation, but if there were a lawsuit and the data were in the possession of the State Patrol, everything is discoverable unredacted, is it not?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and Senator Letts, under the current law, I believe that the State Patrol would redact everyone except the subject that made the request. And I think that is in an abundance of caution and a lack of clarity in the law, as which we're trying to make more clear now. Under Burks, I think they're totally entitled to the unredacted data, even though they don't get it. And so that forces them to make a motion to the court, either side, and it happens on both plaintiff or defense, to get the unredacted data. And as we did talk with the Colonel earlier today, and our team is looking, we've had this arise more with local law enforcement jurisdictions, and we don't, at least I can't present to you today, a case where we have not gotten the information that we need or sufficient information from the State Patrol. So we haven't had a court order to release the unredacted data with the State Patrol, but we have it in multiple instances by consent with local jurisdictions. So right now it is comes to you redacted, and that is the expense that we're hoping to avoid in those appropriate cases. I don't think this expands the amount of requests that will be made. It won't expand the amount of accidents that happen. This is public data that subjects are entitled to, and we're trying to expedite the process, not make it more difficult.
Chair Letts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What if Ms. Primo can help me understand, under current data practices law, if data, recorded data like this, is subject to litigation and active lawsuit, what restrictions, if any, are there on the release of that data, redacted or unredacted?
Ms. Prima.
Madam Chair and members, private data or not public data under the Government Data Practices Act is still subject to discovery. There's a balancing test.
that the court engages in if a government entity does not want to provide that data because of the requirements of Chapter 13. So in this case, the requirements that certain data be redacted. And so I'll point you to 13.03, subdivision 6, which addresses the discoverability of not public data. And the court must then look at whether the data is discoverable under the applicable rules of evidence, civil procedure, or criminal procedure, and then conduct a balancing test about whether release of that data outweighs the harm to the individual. And in some cases, there are some requirements to try to notify the subject of the data if release is warranted.
Chair Letts.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Ms. Primo, that would include release to the parties to the litigation or release beyond that?
Ms. Primo.
Madam Chair and members, it would be something that pertains to that party because it would be in the context of, let's say, you know, discovery motions and compelling discovery. And I'm assuming that a party could obtain a protective order as to that data if it's appropriate and the judge would decide that. But there's nothing in the statute that specifically addresses what happens once the court has ruled, yes, that data is discoverable, and yes, the balancing test weighs in favor of providing that data.
Chair Letts.
So what I'm trying to ascertain is, as you may gather, Chair Mahler, is, you know, what's the current process and how far does current data practices law allow it to go or restrict it? And it sounds like as a practical matter in litigation, most of the stuff gets released. Maybe practice is a little bit different between local agencies and the State Patrol in terms of redaction. And that balancing test, if someone were to challenge it, it would be the court doing the balancing analysis under the Data Practices Act. So as a practical matter, I guess what I'd like to see facilitated is not having to go to, not having to file a lawsuit just to get the evidence in the case that would enable a claimant and the other party to figure out, is there a resolution to this claim without having to go to a lawsuit. And that would mean you'd have to have discovery, which typically can be done without actually filing the lawsuit, or even pre-litigation, the parties just exchange information. So I'm not quite sure how we strike that balance here, if we need to fashion some specific rules or if we just leave it and the State Patrol can, if they receive the request and the claimant's attorneys feels that there's stuff that's redacted that they don't want, or maybe the State Patrol says we're going to have to go through it and redact, and then the claimant's attorney says, well, we need more than that. We'll go to court and get it figured out. Maybe you won't have to go through the process of redaction. But the idea here, I think, was to facilitate the exchange of information, which is standard in discovery, without forcing the government agency to go through the whole process of redaction and delay, or forcing the lawsuit, where the lawsuit may not even be necessary in the case. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other member questions? Chair Nabhani.
For the Colonel, just for an example, it's a February day afternoon commute. There's an ice storm. We have Crashmageddon, 100 crashes, State Patrol writes in a couple of hours. How many minutes of body camera video could be, if there was 100 crashes and no one's going to hold you to this, how many minutes of video would be produced on one evening drive?
Colonel Bogievich.
Madam Chair, approximately 30 minutes per crash is what we would typically see one trooper spend at a very basic traffic crash. Again, if you're talking injury crash or a fatal crash, we would typically have anywhere from 3, 5 to 7 troopers, all with body-worn camera.
Chair Nabhani.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And that's what I, but it's exponentially explosive number. And as you said, you throw in an injury, you throw in an investigation, it's a mind-blowing number of minutes that have to be looked at. So even if they don't do a redaction under this policy, you're still going to have to review it to make sure that it complies with the, that there's data that is clearly offensive and offensive to common sensibilities, and that there's not other things in there that would violate. So someone is still going to physically have to sit down and scan every second of every minute of these videos that are going to be released to make sure that they can't be released unredacted. I just don't see how we do it. You know, if you look for a side-by-side, this is such a problem with the BCA and the officer-involved shootings, and we're making changes to that because it is such a big problem. So take that February ice storm crash, throw in untold number of minutes, it's all going to be reviewed. All of a sudden, the State Patrol is getting just buried under these requests, and then we still have the provision under this of 14 days that they're released. I just don't see how that works. And you know, typically, you know, you talked about the process that you have now, that if the parties that are subject to the data make the request and again give you permission to release it, that that's okay. But wouldn't the subjects of the data also include people that help, people that come by, tow truck drivers? You know, anybody is going to be the subject of data. Contacting each one of those, even if you know who they are, that's a Herculean task right there, and that's on every case. And then redo that every time for each one of these cases. I just don't see how we can do everything that the bill wants within the timeline that they want.
Colonel?
Madam Chair, you are correct. There are some exceptions which then require us to review all video associated with that event, including the things you had pointed out, also taking into consideration juveniles involved, undercover officers, CJIS information or computer CAD information when the officer's responding to the scene. That is considered private data, and so we would have to review to ensure that all of that is redacted if needed.
And Mr. Carlson?
Yeah. Madam Chair and Rosam Novotny, just so we're clear, this is not creating any new access to data. This is not a new request. We have this right already. We're not creating anything new. The only thing that we're trying to do in those situations where it works is to save the expense of the redaction, because at the end of the day, under Burks, we're going to get the information at the end of the day. This doesn't create a new right to access data. Though that accident scenario, you know, everyone that's involved in an accident that is subject to that data has the right right now to request that. It's just how expensive do you have to make it to get the data for everyone involved. So we have the right to get it, and I believe and support, and we're not changing the general rule of subjects needing to consent to the release of the data. We've talked about many times the domestic violence call out, and you don't want to release that video. We're not changing any of that. This is only in the situation where there is an accident report prepared and it would be permissive to allow law enforcement to give this data out without redacting it. That's all this is trying to accomplish.
Chair Novotny.
And I think that's the problem, Mr. Carlson, is that it there is so many people, there would still be a huge amount of time going through. It's not just the two drivers or three drivers in a crash. It's everyone else. It's the passengers. It's the bystanders. It's everyone that comes along. some people have old habits and they can't pass up, but they can't go past an accident if they think somebody needs help. So that's where I don't think that it's really connecting that these are all subjects of the data. I don't know how the State Patrol is going to, or anyone else, any other law enforcement agency is going to have the wherewithal to track down all these people to get the release. You know, it's they're still going to have to make sure that there's somebody that's not protected. It's I just don't see how this works under the time, given the volume that it could be. Thank you, Chair.
Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And if I'm understanding this correctly, and please tell me if I'm not, so this is, Mr. Carlson, this is intended to kind of speed up the process of getting this data. And is it the idea being that maybe sometimes you could get the data and then maybe you'd end up not filing a lawsuit and not needing more, you know, maybe it doesn't need to be, I mean, maybe you'll see that your client was at fault and you'll go, oh, we should settle the case and end of story. That's kind of, you're nodding yes. So let me ask this other question. Maybe this is completely naive, but would some of this interest, it seems to me that there is a, I mean, there's a real struggle here of how to do this thing that it seems to me would be pretty reasonable to do, but there's a this problem of the mechanics of it. Might there be a position where a right to look at the data without actually being given a copy would be sort of a middle position? I mean, that's just something, I don't know, there's probably a lot that would have to be worked out there, but that was kind of a thought that I had just listening to this. And one other thing I just want to say before I give it to you to respond is that Chair Novotny talking about all that's involved and so on, I have a feeling that AI is going to impact this at some point, and this whole process is going to be a lot easier because there will be some ability to scan all this stuff and have sort of an initial, here's the thing you need to focus on, but that's neither here nor there. But I'd love to hear what you have to say about the thought of doing it a different way.
Well,
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and Chair Liebling, absolutely happy to look at a different way of getting this. We're trying to expedite an expensive process. But for the State Patrol, and I've been working on this one for some time, I haven't really had this pushback from law enforcement. So I want to make sure that we satisfy their concerns. I'm very sympathetic to it, and they do handle more accidents across the state than anyone. So having the ability to review the data, even if you're not provided a copy of it, is helpful because right now you don't. You just get the, you know, your face and that's it. And it is not very helpful to as a discovery tool to find out really what happened. And so we're absolutely open to that. And also, as we went through with the patrol's lawyer earlier today, there's a couple words in here that we could improve on that haven't been raised on line 170.7. It says it must be provided. That absolutely can be a maybe provided. And then on the release of the data on 170.11, it says it may only be used for the case and the claim. That could absolutely be a must only be used. I think those are minor details, but I mean, as we were going through it in more detail, I think there are things that we can work on that make this system better and more efficient, and it is extremely, Representative Novotny, I agree, time-consuming, costly, and cumbersome, and that's what we're trying to cut through in those instances where at the end of the day, you're going to get access to all that data in the first place. And this is all discoverable information, and you're going to get it unless there is some legitimate law enforcement reason not to release it.
Chair Liebling, anything further? Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one of the things that was discussed very briefly here was that there was no, I think the colonel said this, that there was no consequence if the data that you might get was released further, because it says you can't do it, but in the Data Practices Act, there are penalties for that. There's no penalty here that, or cause of action that we can see. And so that was something that, even though, well, I think it's just something that would be worth considering. And I know you've been getting this data anyway, and nothing has happened that we know of. But is that something that would that you could work with?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and Representative Scott, absolutely, although in my mind, as this was going through judiciary, I don't think when we added that section that anybody around the table was thinking that a lawyer would violate his ethical duties of releasing data that he's not authorized to release. This is only to be used for settling a case or as courtroom evidence. Once it's used as courtroom evidence, it is public, right? That is just the fact of life. But we don't have any intention of that. I assume that releasing it is a violation of the Data Practices Act, and we'd be subject to it like anyone else, as well as court sanction. So we weren't really thinking about the penalty side of it. We just, you know, we don't want to put this on the nightly news. We want to use it as evidence to resolve cases, maybe even before they happen, to have to get to court. So.
Chair Scott? That's it. Chair Letts.
Thank you. One of the reasons I wanted to see a copy of the fiscal note is part of the question here that Chair Novotny raised, which was, you know, this is a lot of work to go through it and figure out what's should be redacted, what shouldn't be. But to Mr. Carlson's last point, that process will happen anyway. This is not going to create any new work whatsoever. The only question is the timing of the work. It's either going to be released after a lawsuit is filed and there's formal discovery, or it's going to be released pre-lawsuit. So there are two pieces to this. One is trying to expedite, meaning bring earlier in the process, the request and authorizing the release. And then the second one, part of it, is to avoid the need for the redaction, which is also in here. This is the way I'm seeing it anyway. So if we create, if we allow, even if it goes through the whole redaction process, there's no fiscal note there because there's no new work for the State Patrol to do. They're going to have to do it anyway down the road if they don't release it pre-litigation. So I don't understand where $3 or $4 million comes in on a fiscal note. That's why I want to see it, see what those assumptions are. It's only a question of the timing of the work, but the work is going to happen. Now, then the question to me is, ought there to be a litigation exception to the redaction requirement? Or a presumption in there? And if there need to be additional guardrails around that, something that explicitly... I mean, it does here say on lines 170.12, the requester must not further disseminate the data or use the data for any purpose. It's only evidence in a proceeding relating to the collision. That's the restriction. But if there need to be stronger guardrails for people to be comfortable with it, I mean, I'm fine with that. But the litigation exception to a redaction requirement for data that ultimately could be available, I think in whole, to a litigator, if the case were going to go to trial, they'd need to see everything to be able to prove or disprove the case. Both sides are going to want all the data. Then that's where the cost savings come in, if you can avoid the redaction requirements altogether for this limited litigation purpose. But I think there are two decision points for this committee on this issue. One is should it be available pre-litigation? And the second decision point is, can there be a limited litigation exception to the redaction requirement subject to appropriate restrictions to make sure it's not inappropriately used or disseminated? That's the way I'm seeing it.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate those suggestions. I think those are suggestions that I don't know about Chair Liebling, but I would certainly want to vet through our committee. This bill hasn't been heard in the House, and anytime you're tinkering around with Chapter 13, especially making an exception for redaction for litigation, I'm not ruling it out. It's a very interesting idea. that needs a lot of nuance, I think. And I just don't feel like conference committee with a week to go in session is maybe the best place to vet this out. That's just my comment, I guess.
All right, anything further?
Was it introduced in the House? We're checking.
Yep. I'm seeing both heads nodding yes and no. Can we get a House file number for what the House, where the bill was in the House?
Madam Chair.
House file 2938 is what I'm hearing. It was not heard, but it was introduced in the House. Correct.
And referred to which committee?
And referred to Judiciary.
Pardon me? Whose bill was it?
Madam Chair?
I mean, where?
Representative Duran.
Chair Lutz.
With all due respect, we're hearing a number of things that were introduced in one body, or both bodies, had hearings in one body but not in the other. I certainly respect the committee process, and it's important to go through that. But we also sometimes have to move things through conference committee that haven't had full vetting in both bodies, but they've had vetting in one body or the other. So I'm trying to problem solve here under the circumstances. And yeah, we are a week away from the end of the session, but I don't think that absolves us as trying to problem solve if we can while we're here.
Madam Chair. Chair Liebling.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm a little bit confused because we were just talking about a litigation exception. And I thought that was kind of a suggestion of something we might do, but that's not really what's before us here, right? Am I confused there? I thought Chair Scott was talking about if we were going to do some kind of further, like create a litigation exception, that would need to go through committee, but that's, or was that referring to what's here as a litigation exception? I just was a little confused about that.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just trying to rephrase what Senator Lass's suggestions were for redaction in Chapter 13, that there would be some sort of exception for litigation, so they wouldn't, it wouldn't have to go through the redaction process up front, I think is what he was getting at. You can correct me if I'm misunderstanding that, Chair Lass, but does that make it?
Well, it looks like Chair Liebling has a follow-up. Chair Liebling.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Is that what we're talking about here, or is that something in addition? Senator Lass, maybe this is more a question for you. Were you suggesting that we create something additional to what is here before us, or are you kind of referring to this as a litigation exception?
Chair Lutz.
Madam Chair and Chair Liebling and Chair Scott, I guess I've been thinking of this as a litigation exception, right. But I'm looking at the actual language, and it simply says the requester. And I'd have to look a little more closely at this, but may only be used to process a claim relating to the collision or as evidence in a proceeding related to the collision. So maybe thinking of it as a litigation exception is a narrower solution if the language in here isn't tightly drafted enough for people to be comfortable with. Oh, maybe Mr. Carlson has a little clarity to offer on that point.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and members, I think narrowing down this exception and how it applies, we use the words claim and court, and we are getting at the litigation process. It is limited to those people that are entitled to an accident report that's prepared by the patrol. Those are only limited to the people in the accident, their insurance companies, their lawyers, or their next of kin. So that's the only field we're talking about here, the subjects of the data. And if they are involved in a claim and they ask for the data, they could get it unredacted unless they have an objection to giving it out. That's as simple as I can explain it. And we're happy to work through getting to the right language, including having the right, or council having the right, to view the data without getting an actual copy of it. That may advance the ball significantly, because that doesn't happen right now. And so I think we can get there. We're not creating a new right to get this data, and we're not touching, you know, officer-involved shooting, any of the other body-worn camera provisions that you have. It's only as it relates to an accident report, very limited.
All right, and I think I feel like there maybe could be some work done that might resolve some of the issues now with the time we have left. I also just want to note that the question about the House bill, it was introduced on April 1st, and our policy deadline was April 4th, so it came in very, it came in very late. So there was no fault, I think, with it not being heard in our Judiciary Committee with the short timeline, but I really appreciate the willingness of the testifiers to look at the language, work on it, and I think we still have a little bit of time left where we can continue to explore that. All right. Oh, Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, I'll own the April Fool's Day introduction. I had the pleasure of working with a freshman member who was in law enforcement and had talked to both chairs about this bill coming. And so it wasn't laying in the weeds, but it did take him a while to get his name on it and put it in. So I'll own that one.
All right. Very well. All right. Thank you both for being here. Next, we're going to move on to Senate File 1909. That's Senator Umu Verbatim's bill. And this is related to wage theft investigations. Yep. All right. So this one is at Article 6, R1, lines 103.16 to 105.2. And we'll move to that. I'll give everybody a minute here to find it in their bill. A6. Let me say it one more time. It's A6. R1, lines 103.16 to 105.2. And our first testifier is Joel Hansen. Welcome to the committee. And whenever you're ready, you can introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joel Hansen. I'm Director of Government Affairs with Associated Builders and Contractors. We're a construction industry trade organization that represents 350 local members who employ 20,000 men and women in the construction trade industry across the state. So appreciate you allowing me the opportunity to pick up this conversation that began last week on this provision. And as was discussed last week in committee, county attorneys currently do have the ability to request these financial records of employers subject to wage theft investigations through the search warrant process. Obviously, this language of Senate File 1909 would expand that to administrative subpoena powers for county attorneys to include the financial and accounting records of employers or other persons who are the subject of a wage theft investigation. And so, in changing the standard from a search warrant to an administrative subpoena, we do have some comments regarding the language, and I will point you to R1A6, and it's line 104.16 that states, any of the following records of an employer or other person or business entity is the subject of a wage theft investigation. As that language appears, other person is undefined, and we find it to be ambiguous and potentially lead to unintended consequences. I would also point you to the language on line 104.21, and that language expands the subpoena to, quote, other records that in any way relate to wages or other income paid, hours worked, et cetera. Again, other records that in any way relate appears undefined, at least as it is in that statute. And if you look at the underlying statute, it doesn't appear that language is subject to anything else that's in this list of administrative subpoenas, the ability to look for those documents. And then I would also point to the language on lines 104.25 through 104.27. So while the language in the statute requires that these subpoenas be relevant to an ongoing criminal investigation, At least in the case of wage theft, it doesn't require that there be probable cause to believe a crime is being committed. And so we would be moving from a standard of what would be a search warrant to now an administrative subpoena that does not require probable cause. So those are some of the concerns that we've had. We've had conversations briefly here with the Superintendent Evans as well as the Carpenters to go through this. And I will say I just want to thank the committee, though, for adopting the same language. R12, Article 3, Section 19, that consolidates financial crimes in the BCA. And so with that, thank you for your time. I'll stand for questions.
All right, we'll just keep moving on with testifiers here. And next up, we have Mr. Kajewski. I probably still said it wrong. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I acknowledge that even phonetically it's hard to pronounce. I'm Richard Kajewski, the Government Affairs Director for the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters, and thank you for just a minute to testify this evening. When it comes to wage theft, the Carpenters certainly are at the forefront of advocacy in this area, and unfortunately, these cases take far too long to resolve, and it's at the expense of more and more victims. We've engaged some of the parties on this language here, and we think we can get to some sort of resolution. But I want to share, you know, in the past 5 to 7 years, you know, the legislature has passed different bills that contribute to shutting down some of these criminal enterprises. However, we think back to cases, and I'll say them publicly. Ricardo Batras was a great case that was prosecuted in Hennepin County. Leroy and Joyce Muir, their business was completely shut down. They were prosecuted successfully. Fabian Espinoza, Nelson Lopez, Jose Marino. These are cases that the Carpenters really spent a lot of time and energy on and worked them through to the end. But I would also tell you, probably to nobody's surprise here in committee, that those took years to resolve. Those weren't one worker coming forward with a complaint and all of a sudden there was this great wage theft case that was prosecuted by a county or any other law enforcement entity. And despite our work on this legislation, you know, criminals get more and more intelligent, I guess, if you will, on how to manipulate the system. And so that's why we continue to come back to the legislature and look for fixes in trying to shut this down. And this language here that's in statute before you is another way to smooth out that process to help prosecute some of these people that are actually creating these victims out there. And they're in every one of your neighborhoods, I guarantee it. It's a massive, massive problem that we absolutely cannot single-handedly get our arms around. And so I share that with you here, and I also urge you to take a look at this with that in mind and consider how do we stop the victimization of workers. It's nonstop. And I've told this story numerous times, and some of you have heard it, but when I go to work right down the street here, every morning at 7:30, there's people waiting to get into the building to talk to our reps who have been ripped off on a job site. That's how bad the problem is, every day. So I thank you, Madam Chair, for the time, and I urge you to think about how we give every entity that's willing to prosecute these cases and willing to spend the resources on them the tools they need to get this work done. And I look at this language here before us as another opportunity and another tool to stop some of this fraud and theft. Thank you.
Thank you. And if you can please stick around, too, for any questions that members have. And then Superintendent Evans, I don't know if you're here just for questions. If they come up, you don't have, like, anything prepared. Okay. Well, then we can move on to member questions. Senator Umu-Verbaten.
Thank you. I'd like to call up Superintendent Evans to ask a few questions.
All right, go ahead with your question.
That's right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Superintendent Evans. I understand the Commerce Fraud, what was the Commerce Fraud Bureau, is now moved over into BCA. Just wondering if you could share a little bit more about how those wage theft cases are handled what your work looks like with any county attorneys, and then in your understanding of the bill, this would help expedite and process those wage theft cases.
And if you could begin by introducing yourself again, Superintendent, that'd be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Umar-Verbaten. I'd be happy to do so. My name is Drew Evans, again, for the record. I'm the Superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Both the BCA and the Commerce Fraud Bureau have conducted wage theft investigations, and we would agree with Richard in terms of the growth of these types of cases and what that represents to workers across Minnesota when they're not paid the wages that are due to them for the work that they've completed. There are, though, difficult cases at times to prove, because oftentimes when law enforcement responds, it appears to be a conflict between an employer and an employee in those situations. And so when we work through those cases, they often are very much record driven. So this type of change to the law in whatever manner, and I should be clear while we do this work, this is not a policy proposal from the BCA in this, but the work that would be done and the records that we gathered in terms of that historical look back is just the type of information we would use to put these types of cases together. Looking at some of those financial records, bankroll, determining what work may have been done by the particular individual, for example, and whether or not they were paid, whether or not the proper workers' compensation insurance was in place at the time for those employees, etc. And so oftentimes these are, I think that is alluded to, they are time intensive, and it is very much a historical records-based case what we're often investigating those particular cases. And so gathering the information in an efficient way. Also, there is a situation where it could be a scenario where a crime hasn't been committed. And so using administrative authority, subpoena authority in these cases would allow us to quickly sift through the information provided to determine whether or not we do believe a crime is occurring in this situation, or if not, we're able to quickly identify that it may not be a prosecutable case and move on to the next case that we'd be investigating.
Senator Umar-Verbaten.
Thank you. This might be a follow-up for you and possibly for Richard as well. I've heard a lot about some of just the civil violations and the struggle to prove those cases that often the Department of Labor and Industry is doing, where, you know, there are business models where people are intentionally paid under the table, they've had to piece things together through text messages. So I'm just curious if you could talk about other records that do relate to wages, what those might look like in these cases.
All right, our Superintendent Evans.
Yeah, I'd be happy to start, Senator. I'm happy to go through that. You know, when we're looking at this, and certainly can weigh in, one of the challenges that has been, as I've become more engaged in this, is that we have a number of different state agencies that are engaged when wage theft or misclassification type crimes occur, or civil or regulatory occur in those situations. The Department of Labor and Industry, Commerce, the BCA, we all own different pieces of this when it comes to this, amongst others in this process. And the construction industry is one, for example, that is, you know, largely dependent, and Richard's certainly the expert on this, of utilizing a number of contractors, general contractors, subcontractors in there throughout. And so it is one of those industries that is ripe for this type of crime to be able to occur, because there are so many different pieces, as opposed to if you think of a traditional corporation where it's very large and you have all these employees working for that particular corporation, there's a lot of different business relationships that exist in that process. And so those other records that we've been looking for are things like workers' compensation insurance, for example. That's a situation where if they say they don't have any employees, but yet we know there's employees that are working, that would be another piece to provide. Or they say they do have employees. All these different records that they would keep, roles of the individuals, the contracts that are being entered into with the contractor that's above or below them, all those different types of records are what we would need to go through to be able to piece together, to be able to fully understand exactly what that relationship was between the complainant that's complaining a crime was committed in a wage theft and the individual that they're saying was involved in that.
And Mr. Kajewski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just add to that. I mean, we spend a lot of time. I can share with you, there's a site now, there's 80 workers who are being victimized as we speak, that we go through on the civil side, and we work with getting affidavits from those workers. We try to get some sort of payroll record, whether it's a photograph of them being paid in cash, Certainly in this committee, you just had discussion and you've had plenty of discussion throughout session to know that video becomes the standard. So a lot of times we try to get video of transactions that are happening that are not above board, we'll just say that. So it takes a lot of time, and when we're working with a large pool of workers, it becomes a big undertaking. And frankly, we don't, I mean, we're limited on staff just like everybody else. We might have one or two staff working on wage theft on a daily basis.
Senator Umuver-Bain.
Thank you. That was all really helpful. I don't know that I have another question, but I would just again point out that this is the most serious form of wage theft, which is, of course, a crime. There's the civil violations that happen. There's now intergovernmental partnership that is working to kind of coordinate because there's so many pieces that are impacted. And so we want to make sure, of course, those victims are made whole first and receive their wages that they're owed. But there can be tax evasion. There's money that should have gone into unemployment insurance, into other government programs. Taxpayers are defrauded. This is fraud. And I think that we should be doing everything we can this year to give law enforcement the tools that they need to combat it. I think it's really that simple.
Chair Nabani.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Boy, I would agree. Wage theft is horrible. It's at an alarming rate in some of these areas. And it's not just a metro area. It does go on out in the rural area for farm labor. But we're not here to talk about the wage theft crime. That's established. We're here to talk about the provision of this bill, which would give county attorneys an expanded right to do subpoena power. Superintendent Evans, by the time you establish who the person is, the establish where you suspect that these bank records are, that you could tell the county attorney to do the subpoena for you and make that request for the subpoena, you've obviously established a pretty good set of circumstances. Is there anything that you could see that the subpoena would get you that you couldn't just as easily get a search warrant or nearly as easily get a search warrant and get the same information from a search warrant?
Superintendent.
Madam Chair, Chair Novotny and members, I want to be very careful since this is not our proposal in terms of answering your question, because I think in answering it, I think in particular what I would note is on lines 104.16, 104.18, 1.19 in particular. Those are very transactional records, you know, in terms of the books that you'd be able to look at that would help establish to determine that on the front end when you originally get a complaint, to be able to see some of those transactional payroll records, for example, books, registers, banking records, credit card, that you can see, you know, are also in alignment with some of the other provisions that are listed, you know, in the administrative subpoena authority previously. Those alone would move a case like that from a suspected crime that's been reported to be able to determine some veracity as to the complaint that's being made by looking at with the entity itself. The others, as you noted, some of the more broad provisions, and I think as was testified to the other day from the county attorney, you would often have probable cause, as you note, in those situations to be able to get a search warrant to get those records.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Superintendent Evans, the line you referred to, 104.8, is already in statute. We're looking at 104.18. And I'll go back to my original question. By the time you get to the threshold to I have identified all these records that you're looking at, they're very specific, what you're going to be going after at that point, I think you'd have the established cause to get a search warrant anyway. And some of these things, and I realize that there's provisions that for where the subpoenas can be served, but I just don't see where you couldn't just get a warrant for this anyway. So thank you, Chair.
Further member questions? All right. I'm not seeing any. Thank you very much for your testimony. And that is it as far as bills that we were going to have testimony on. And next, we are going to move to adopt two policy provisions. Chair Latz, Senator Latz, I believe, well, Chair, too, sorry. I believe you have a motion.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt Senate language Article 2, R24, Section 16, lines 27.1 to 27.25. This language requires law enforcement to register for e-trace system and report on recovered or confiscated firearms. And I do have an amendment to that language that's there.
All right. I can tell you in the record. Yes, please go ahead and tell us about the amendment.
The amendment would be on page 27, line 23, delete a, and insert an expended. Page 27, line 24, delete submit, and insert arrange to have, and after information, insert submitted. So the amendment is to subdivision 2C, starting on line 27.3 altogether, would read as follows. Whenever an expended shell casing is recovered or confiscated by a law enforcement agency, that agency must, as soon as practicable, arrange to have the ballistics information submitted to the National Integrated Ballistics Information Network.
All right. Any thank you, Chair Latz. Any questions about the amendment? Chair Novotny?
I think it's a great amendment.
All right. Any further questions? So the motion is actually for the language as amended. We, because it's not regular committee, we don't have to actually adopt an amendment. So this is a little bit different. So all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. And Senator Seeberger, I believe you also have a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I move Senate language Article 4, which is on page R22, sections 20 and 21, lines 78.17 through 80.12. And this would be with the A25 amendment.
And before you describe the amendment, can you just tell us what, just generally what this portion of the bill does?
This portion of the bill relates to AI-generated child sexual abuse material. Let's see. Do you want me to go in further detail? Let me find it. And what it does is it adds AI to the definition of child sexual abuse material to be able to prosecute that.
Okay, great. And then if you want to explain how your amendment fits in.
The amendment would add on page 79, line 24, after the word conduct, it would insert the words and is obscene.
Okay, any discussion to the amendment or questions? Any discussion to the actual motion with the amendment? All right, seeing none, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. All right, anything else from any of the members today?
Superintendent Evans, still around.
Yeah, can
Yes. I have a question. Oh, it looks like we may have one more wage theft question. I think Superintendent Evans is maybe regretting the fact that he's still here. Go ahead, Chair Latz.
From my view, he was hiding behind Richard, so I didn't see him there. Thank you, Madam Chair and Superintendent Evans. I'm also seeking the kind of clarification that Chair Novotny was seeking. And maybe you can't give a definitive answer here. But I've got the same question, which is, what could you get with an administrative subpoena that you wouldn't be able to get with a search warrant signed by a judge as a part of these investigations? Why not just leave the law as it is and have everyone get a search warrant?
Superintendent.
Chair Latz and members of the committee, when it comes to this, I mean, I think that's true for any records in general under the administrative subpoena authority. I think if you had probable cause, you would be able to get any of those records. You know, the administrative subpoena authority that's built into the statute is often used as, you know, a piece as you're building an investigation, that there's certain transactional type records that you as policymakers have determined. But to specifically answer your question, I mean, those records, there's none that wouldn't be available if we have probable cause to do that. I think the challenge can become on some of these is any criminal investigation, when you get the original complaint from the individual that's alleging wage theft occurred, that these records would be able to, you know, push you in the direction of affirming or showing us that that did not occur early on in the investigation, potentially before, and as noted in those first lines, that a violation has occurred by looking and seeing anomalies in some of those payroll records, banking records, et cetera, specific to wage theft. But to be clear, you're correct in terms of your comment that, you know, a search warrant would make these records available for sure.
Chair Latz.
Chair Mueller, Superintendent. So let's say you've got a construction worker who shows up at the carpenter's hall and says, they paid me in cash today. I got shorted $3 an hour and they didn't, you know, pay FICA or whatever, you know, whatever else is going on with the wage theft. Carpenter's hall says, we're going to refer you to an investigator at the BCA because they do these investigations. And you sit down and you talk with that worker. And maybe that worker says, here are names of two other workers. Same situation, and here's a video. Do you think that's enough, without getting business records, to fill out an application for a search warrant and get a judge to say, there's probable cause here, here's your authority to go see what's in the business records?
Superintendent.
Chair Latz, Madam Chair, I think with your scenario as you described, there's likely probable cause in that scenario. If you have video showing an alleged violation, I think more likely it'd be one individual where you would get the transactional history, for example, that did that. We talked to the site supervisor or the subcontractor. They say, no, I paid them. They're not telling you the truth, or he did that. Those transactional payroll, other records that would be available, you might be able to discover anomalies in the record keeping that would point you towards, you know, the veracity of the complaint that was made, which would then lead you to the search warrant to get the more expansive records in that particular scenario. So as I noted, there's other portions of this, again, not the policy provision from the BCA being offered, but that are broader there that might, you know, be more attuned to a search warrant that you'd be looking for, that expansive as you're trying to determine whether or not there's an ongoing ongoing criminal enterprise, for example, that's utilizing this on a regular basis, that might lead us to say labor trafficking as opposed to the individual wage theft allegation that was being made.
Chair Latz.
Chair, Superintendent, so I can back up a second because you hit a couple of things there. You get one person complains, that's all you know. You go talk to the superintendent, superintendent says, no, that's not happening. So now it's a credibility question. Do you think you've got enough to fill out a search warrant application, go to a judge and say, we've got what we believe is a credible allegation? In order to flesh that out, we need some business records to figure out if there's enough really to move forward. We may or may not end up developing enough to go forward with a criminal case, but to figure that out, we need business records. We don't have administrative subpoena power. Is that enough in that hypothetical, in your experience, to get a search warrant?
Superintendent.
Madam Chair, Chair Latz, I think that would be pushing it with that scenario as to whether or not you have probable cause at that point in time. That doesn't mean there aren't other additional steps we take to develop that probable cause to get to those same records, you know, in terms of there might be other ways to do that, interview people at the site, for example, other ways that you might be able to work through doing that where you develop that. But I think just one allegation back, if there's a disagreement, that in and of itself I think would be challenging to get a search warrant to get those records.
Okay. So, Superintendent, sure, so there's a workaround to not getting the business records directly, which is to investigate in other ways to try to develop other evidence. But what I hear you saying is that if you could get the records administratively, you might be able to see it more quickly, whether there's there or there isn't. Am I understanding that correctly?
Superintendent.
Madam Chair, Chair Latz, yes, correct.
Okay, and then you went into...
Chair Latz.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. And then you went into a, you know, a further steps down the road. Maybe there's more there than we really thought there was. And you wouldn't know that unless you got a hold of the records. But the first question is, can we get some records and how do you do it? My concern is that just on the basis of a challenged credibility of a complainant, you might not have enough to look any further. And then it becomes something of a question of efficiency. You know, do we put all of our resources over here to develop more facts? Be like, you know, someone reports that we think there's drug dealing going on in this house, and then you send an officer over there on a Friday morning at 5 a.m. to do a trash pull, and maybe you find something, and then you've got probable cause for a search warrant. But if there's nothing there, then maybe you don't. You know, then it's a question of efficiency, and maybe you never get across that threshold. So I understand, you know, the concern here is at what point do you require that constitutional probable cause to believe a crime has occurred, which is the basis for a search warrant, am I right? Or is it just an articulable suspicion, which might not get you a search warrant, but it's enough for more investigation? And I think that would kind of be the threshold, I would think, for an administrative subpoena. I'll stand corrected if I'm wrong on the law there as well.
Superintendent.
Madam Chair, Chair Latz, I think you described that very accurately in terms of how the administrative, there's an efficiency component. That's why the administrative subpoena authority, as you can see, there's a number of categories. They tend to be very limited in scope just for that reason that you've outlined.
And I'm going to press you on your non-policy position as well, because it sounded like you might have been identifying maybe a somewhat narrower amendment or drafting to add to the statute that might help things out without being overly broad. But I didn't quite catch where you were going with this.
Superintendent, I'm not sure what you're...
Chair Muller and Chair Latz.
I'm not sure if the author of this provision is happy with me asking this question here. I'm trying to figure out if there's a way forward here.
Yeah, and I certainly, the stakeholders that have been involved in this, I think they've raised some good points, certainly with Senator Umar Verbaeten. I'd want you to have some of those conversations. But I do think that narrow reading, there would be value in furthering those investigations if it was putting this in a place where people would feel comfortable with it moving forward, that those lines alone would add value to those investigations and be able to move quickly and efficiently to identify those crimes or be able to clear individuals as well. As we've had conversations with others, I do understand some of the concerns that have been raised about other person in that process that's expansive without a definition, some of the other pieces. But the lines in particular identified, just knowing our work and what we do, I would see value to those as we're working through that criminal investigative process.
Thank you.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Chair Scott was first, but
I saw both hands raised, so I don't know. Go ahead. Chair Liebling.
Superintendent, can you help me understand? I don't have a lot of experience with the administrative subpoena thing. I know what execution of a search warrant looks like. It can be pretty intrusive. Is the administrative subpoena what does that look like in practice? Is that more of a request for records? Is it somebody knocking on your door in the middle of the night? How is that different, if it is?
Superintendent.
Chair Moeller and Chair Liebling, that's a really good question, and it is much less intrusive. It is a request for records, and it's typically done, you know, either through a portal, email, or, you know, U.S. mail in that, and the subpoena is issued on behalf of law enforcement by the county attorney or attorney general, depending on which statute you're using. That is then provided to the individual holding the records, and then they're typically either provided electronically or via mail or different means that they may do. It might be hand delivery, but this is not as nearly as intrusive as a search warrant as them providing the business records. We administrative subpoena, but think of it much like a subpoena to produce records in a lawsuit, for example. It's done in a transactional way for a reason.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's really important, an important distinction. I am glad I asked that because just sitting listening to the conversation kind of occurred to me. I mean, obviously, administrative subpoena, you don't need the same level of evidence already, but along with that goes that you don't have the level of intrusiveness, you know. So, I mean, that makes sense. So thank you. I appreciate that.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, Mr. Evans, do you have administrative subpoena power at the BCA?
Superintendent Evans.
Chair Moeller and Chair Scott, no, we do not.
Okay. So, thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Scott.
Thank you for that answer. And so, but Dolly does have administrative subpoena power on these cases. Is that correct?
Superintendent.
Chair Moeller and Chair Scott, a number of state agencies have administrative subpoena authority for their regulatory function. So I believe, as you know, Dolly does have some subpoena authority in this space for their civil regulatory function. That's accurate.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is anyone from Dolly in the room?
I don't know who they are either. So if they are, they might be hiding under their chair at this point.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hoover-Baton.
I did just want to point out that they are investigating those civil violations, but these are criminal cases.
Thank you for that clarification. Chair Scott.
Thank you for that. And so I guess one question I would have in the scenario that Chair Latz laid out where, and I hate to put these hypotheticals out there, but so if one person comes in and they're claiming wage theft, they got paid $3 an hour less than they were contracted or agreed to do so. If you had administrative subpoena power, would you administer an administrative subpoena based on that one allegation? Or would you do some more digging before you went to that level?
Superintendent.
Chair Moeller and Chair Scott, this is a good question in terms of, I don't know that alone, depending on what it was, is enough to be really able to adequately answer your question. It would depend on a number of factors in terms of what they provided, how much we're able to verify, you know, through that process, if they're able to give us information that would lend some credibility to this in the process. You know, as Richard noted, that often we are able to work with a number of the trades that would be able to provide us information about some of these complaints in the process. So it is possible, and don't give this long scenario not to answer the question, that we may. It is possible also that there just isn't enough based on that allegation to move that forward at that point in time. So we may take the report, and then we're watching to see if we get any additional complaints and then might be able to broaden it in that investigation. But it's a long way of saying possibly, but not necessarily. It really depends on the information provided to us.
Chair Scott.
Thank you. I won't ask further questions. I have some, but I'm not going to ask them.
Superintendent.
And, you know, maybe it's fair, Chair Moeller and Chair Scott, along with this, like referencing in Dolly and might be getting a little bit to your question, you know, they might be, as a regulatory agency, be able to do a little bit more digging, you know, with their administrative authority to determine is there a pattern with a particular employer contractor in that process. This, when it comes to that, the reason a lot of those have that direct subpoena authority as a regulatory agency is because you as policymakers want to be that kind of watchdog on the industry as a whole. Typically in those civil regulatory functions, though, that information that's gathered cannot be provided to us as a law enforcement without some sort of search warrant. We keep administrative investigations and criminal investigations separate for good reason so that we are complying with the Constitution, the policies that are enacted here by all of you in the process. And so that is why they tend to be separate and why we don't have it direct and we work through a county attorney's office.
Okay. Any further? Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Superintendent Evans, the legal threshold for getting a search warrant from signed by a judge is probable cause?
Superintendent.
Chair Mueller and Chair Novotny, that's accurate. Probable cause.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Senator Latz, line 104.26, administrative subpoenas may only be issued in welfare fraud and identity theft cases if probable cause to believe a crime has been committed. So would the same administrative subpoena threshold be applied to the wage theft administrative subpoenas?
Chair Latz.
I think that's a question for counsel. Mm-hmm. It's an application of existing statute to the proposed amendment. It's a fair question.
And I think I heard the ABC point this out and this sort of difference between what's currently in statute and with respect to wage theft here. So I don't know, Mr. Backus, if you could.
Chair Mueller, I would add that line limits the use of the administrative subpoena probable cause standard to welfare fraud and identity theft. So I guess as I would read it, administrative subpoenas for other purposes would not have the probable cause standard under existing statute if we were to authorize administrative subpoenas for wage theft cases. The other thing, only other thing while I've got the floor I point out is that this statute proposes to authorize county attorneys, not the BCA, to issue administrative subpoenas.
Right.
Chair Mueller?
You summarized that correctly, that that's currently in the statute's language, and that was, I think, one of the concerns that was raised maybe by ABC, that they weren't included in this. But just so Mr. Backus can clarify, who is currently subject to the probable cause standard in this current statute?
Madam Chair, members, I think it's only that sentence that you read. It's the identity theft cases and the welfare fraud cases. The preceding sentence is the standard for all the other administrative subpoenas, including it would be this one, which is relevant to an ongoing legitimate law enforcement investigation.
Okay, thank you. Chair Novotny.
Chair Mueller, so the question would be, what is the threshold for getting an administrative subpoena on wage theft?
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair and Representative Botany, it would be the sentence beginning on 104.25. Subpoenas may only be issued for records that are relevant to an ongoing legitimate law enforcement investigation. So that's the standard right there.
Chair Novotny.
I think I have my answer, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Anything else? All right, thank you, Superintendent, for coming back. And thanks to our testifiers today and for sticking around this evening with it. We really appreciate it. It is the season of timing uncertainty and late nights. So with that concludes today's agenda, and this meeting is adjourned.